Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is the Frey Podcast, brought to you by thefrey.com, a place for women who want more from life. This is what I want. This is what I need. If you don't have to go, I can set you free. Are you gonna make a move? Are you gonna come and see? Whatever you wanna do, you know it's cool with me. Welcome to today's episode. This podcast is a conversation with Dr. Sarah Ashton from Ships Psychology on attachment theory. I personally have been really fascinated by attachment theory, and it's something that I just think the more people who know and understand what their own attachment style is, the better we are going to be in relationships. And if that famous saying about the quality of your life depending on the quality of your relationships is true, then anything we can do to widen our knowledge and understanding of why we are the way we are in romantic relationships is only going to propel us forward and make life easier. So Dr. Sarah is a registered psychologist, a board-approved supervisor, a researcher, and the director and founder of Ships. She has over 12 years of experience and really prides herself on bringing warmth and respect to the therapeutic space. Sarah's approach to therapy is elective and adaptive. She utilizes the schema therapy approach, internal family systems, sensate therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, mindfulness, acceptance and commitment therapy, dialectal behavior therapy, and EMDR, depending on what the client needs. It's safe to say Sarah is an incredibly intelligent and warm woman. I really enjoyed my conversation with her on attachment theory. During this episode, you can expect to hear a little bit about the origins of attachment theory, when, why, and how it was developed a little bit, what the different styles are, how those different styles present themselves as characteristics and traits, ways that we can work on our attachment style, the combinations of different attachment styles in relationships and the way that that can show up. We also talk about attachment styles in terms of, as parents, how we can promote secure attachment in our children. There's a lot in this conversation and I really hope you enjoy it. I know I definitely loved speaking with Sarah, and I said to her during our conversation, please come back and talk to me again, because she's obviously just such a wealth of knowledge. Now, before we dive into today's episode, it would mean a lot to both Sarah and I if you do take a screenshot, pop it up on your Instagram stories, tag me at Kylie Camps or at @thefrey_, and tag Sarah's account, which is Ships Psychology. You'll find it in the show notes. And I mentioned this at the end of our conversation, but their social media account is brilliant. It's definitely one worth having in your feed. Now, lastly, before the episode really begins, today's podcast is brought to you by Pony Cosmetics. And that is Pony with an I. So Pony Cosmetics have the famous White Knight Mascara. They also have a range of brow products, which I'll talk about in a second. But they also have the blush, bronzer, and highlighter compact that I am obsessed with. I'm actually using their highlighter today. I'm wearing it right now. Their highlighter that's, I guess, designed initially perhaps to go on your cheeks. I wear that as eyeshadow as well as a standard highlighter, and I love it. You can also use the bronzer as an eyeshadow as well. It's one of my favorite combinations. The highlighter kind of, you know, towards your nose. I'm so not a makeup artist, clearly. But that's what I love about these products as well, because they're super buildable. So you don't need to be great with makeup to actually get great results with them. But their highlighter, I put that sort of in the corners towards my nose of my eyes, and then the bronzer in the outer corner. And that's one of my favorite easy eyeshadow looks, but I'm actually using their compacts. So super, super versatile product. They also have the Brow Magic, which is really, really well known. And Brow Magic is the first Pony Cosmetics product I ever tried. And that was years ago. The boys must have been three. It's like the perfect brow pencil, and the Brow Duo Powder with their angled brush is brilliant as well. So if you haven't tried Pony Cosmetics and you want to get amongst it, jump over to the website. There is a link in the show notes, or you can just head to Pony Cosmetics, and don't forget it's P-O-N-I. And if you spend over $50 on the Pony website, you will receive a free full-size white night mascara. So enter the code KylieGift at checkout and get in quick so that you don't miss out, because this offer will expire on the 10th of October. So hopefully you're listening to this episode in real time. Head to Pony Cosmetics, check out their compacts. Their highlighter, bronzer, and blush are brilliant. They all have that ombre tone to them. So there's a gradient in the colors. So you've got your deeper bronze to your lighter, and same with the blush as well. Just super, super easy, buildable, love, love, love them. That code is KylieGift when you spend $50 at Pony Cosmetics for your completely free full-size white night mascara. All right, let's get stuck into my conversation with Dr. Sarah about attachment theory.
Sarah, thank you so much for taking time out of your insanely busy day to have this conversation with me. I'm so grateful.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course. I was reading through your bio on the Ship Psychology website, and I was like, oh my gosh, I want to talk to Sarah about all of these topics, but we'll stick to attachment theory likely today. So let's begin with defining exactly what attachment theory is and how it comes up in our romantic relationships.
Well, attachment theory was developed by John Bowlby, that was in the early 1900s. And he was basically looking at how infants responded when they were separated from their parents. And what he found is that when there was separation that happened, usually they'd go to extraordinary lengths to try and bring about a reunion with their caregiver. So I suppose the important thing to mention about humans is that they're actually the only animal that is completely dependent on their caregivers for survival. So other animals actually are able to take care of themselves in some way, but humans are completely dependent on their caregivers for food, safety, nurturance and reassurance and all the things that they need in order to grow. So essentially what this means is that all the things that happen to us when we're young hardwire our perceptions of ourself and our perceptions of other people in relation to getting our needs met. And the important thing to mention about this is that children are egocentric, right? So they think that everything that happens to them is about them, because parts of their brain haven't developed yet. So what this means is that if they don't get what they need in some way, they assume that it's their fault, and also that it's their job to go and seek it out in some way, or to try and deal with it in some sort of way. So maybe to shut down and repress it. So what attachment theory describes is a person's reaction to, or a child's reaction to, getting their needs met or not, and how this forms a blueprint of their perception of themselves and other people. Mm. And so John Bowlby described different types of categories that tend to define the ways that people typically attach to caregivers. Did you want me to share what they are?
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to add to that and saying that, you know, when I've been listening to certain things about attachment theory and also reading, because I find it so fascinating, and I think going through a divorce will do that to you. You start to kind of like unpack things and be like, oh, interesting. But as I was learning about attachment theory, what I found really interesting with the strange situation experiment, where they actually had that experiment of infants and toddlers, place them in a room, then mum exits the room, watching how the kids respond and try and meet that need of getting their caregiver to come back. But not just in that time frame, but also the focus on then when mum or the caregiver does come back, how they act. You know, does the infant put their arms up and want the caregiver willingly? Or is the infant putting their arms up but then also hitting mum and going, go away as well, like kind of avoiding them? Or do they keep themselves busy with toys and distract themselves? Like, I found it so interesting. It's not just in that space of not having the caregiver present, but also when the caregiver returns. I find it so fascinating. But, yeah, I would love to hear about the styles.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that what that's really indicating is how the child has used their internal resources to deal with that distress, to deal with that separation. And that kind of comes down to temperament. So, you know, that children are really born with, but also just sort of what resources they have internally available to them, and also how what kind of behavior in the caregiver they're dealing with, right? So if we look at attachment styles, you know, some of the adaptations really result from or are born from inconsistent or even kind of abusive behavior, right? So the way that you adapt, the way that you respond, and the way that you respond when, you know, a parent comes back.
The way you cope.
Exactly. It's also... it's dependent on what behavior you're coping with and also what your internal resources are, you know, and then it develops from there.
Yeah. So they developed different categories. Would you mind talking us through those categories?
Yeah. So the ideal, and it's estimated that maybe about half of the population would fall into the category of secure attachment. And this is where you have a positive view of yourself and a positive view of other people. So you tend to think that people are predictable and reliable because your caregivers were predictable and reliable and gave you love and nurturance and safety. So what this means is that, you know, as we grow up, we tend to be comfortable in intimate relationships and also comfortable with independence. And that you're able to form emotional attachments and trust and be intimate with ease. So you have the expectation that things will go well and that people will give you what you need. So you're operating with that assumption in place.
And so typically with people who do fall into the secure category, are they also just better at self-regulation?
Well, that can definitely be part of it, particularly in the context of relational kind of triggers. So there are all sorts of different things that might be difficult for people to regulate, or particular types of emotional experiences that could be triggering. A lot of them are relational for most humans, but some of them might relate to a specific event, you know, or in terms of being able to have control over their behavior, so internally regulate in some way, and also being able to kind of achieve tasks and have reasonable expectations for themselves. So there's things that might fall outside of the category of relationships that still might be challenging for regulation. But yes, absolutely. If you learn to regulate yourself by looking at your parents, and you so they model it for you, they show you what it looks like, and also they co-regulate. So they actually regulate you, and then this allows you to learn how that feels and what that looks like and what that involves. So yes, massive advantage for regulation if you're securely attached.
And what are some other styles for those of us who don't fall so neatly into the secured box?
Yes, those lucky, lucky people.
I know. Before we started recording, I was saying to Sarah that so many people, when I have this conversation with them, you know, just socially, they're like, oh, straight away, secure, I'm secure, I'm secure. But then you get a little further in the conversation and you're like, but are we?
To aspire to.
yes, striving for.
Yeah. So the next category is anxious or preoccupied. And so what this means is that in the situation where a parent is unpredictable or they leave, the response of the child is to seek out, so to move towards the caregiver in order to get their needs met. And so what ends up happening is that they tend to internalize and possess a negative view of themselves, but a positive view of other people. So this is where they assume that the lack of attention, the lack of their needs being met, it must be their fault and not the fault of the other person. So they're more likely to become preoccupied with the behavior of other people and think that they need to do things in order to get their needs met, to achieve intimacy.
That makes so much sense. And I imagine with people who, you know, I don't have to imagine that hard, Sarah, just between you and me with anxious attachment. But, you know, with anxious attachment, then perhaps the way that I'm understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, I really like the way you've explained it, that people in this category who, you know, lean towards this category, they're moving towards someone else, thinking that the more that person pulls back, the more they need to get closer, and that it's really like, oh gosh, I've got to control their behavior. Mm. Or if they leave and do something, that's not about them, that's about me. Like it's, I guess, a little bit more self-centric, back to, you know, kids being obsessed with themselves.
Exactly. You're more likely to assume that it's something you're doing or not doing, or something that you're, you know, lacking, that you're not worthy, that you're not, you know, good enough. All these sort of thoughts and assumptions are really common with people who have anxious attachment. And then they just have a fixation and preoccupation with often monitoring the behavior of people they're in a relationship with, and looking for signs that they're going to pull away or that something is going to change.
And perhaps needing more reassurance.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and they really want a deep sense of intimacy and approval and responsiveness from people. So they'll often really feel like they're kind of not quite getting enough from their partner or partners, you know, and they constantly sort of they want more connection, and that's usually to reassure their anxiety that person is going to leave. But often what happens is that, you know, intimacy is such a kind of tricky space, because it's when someone's close, all they're worried about is, when are they going to leave? When's the, you know, where's the signs that things are going to go wrong? Because they don't have that underlying assumption that securely attached people have, which is that things will be okay, you know. People will show up, they'll stay around, of course they will, you know.
And the old Bader-Meinhof frequency illusion there, like if you believe that, then you're going to look for signs of that and perhaps create more circumstances to prove that belief is true, right? Like if that's your belief from childhood, you're probably going to end up self-sabotaging, because there would be a sense of certainty and reassurance, even though it's, you know, not necessarily a good thing that's happening, but you would feel some relief at being assured that yes, your belief is correct.
That's exactly right. So we usually subconsciously seek out what is familiar to us. So if we're used to having this particular relationship dynamic, you know, you'd sort of think that consciously people would say, no, I really want someone who's going to treat me well and who's going to be available to me. I know that's what I need and I deserve. But guess what? Subconsciously, we're drawn to the familiar, because it makes our world predictable and safe. And also it really influences who we're attracted to as well. You know, we tend to have great chemistry with people who kind of fit in with our blueprint of attachment. So we feel really drawn, like an anxiously attached person might be really drawn to someone who's avoidant, who's not available, you know, because it kind of, there's an underlying.
Feels like home.
Yeah, it does. And also there's there's an attempt almost to externally heal the wound that was caused through anxious attachment or as a part of anxious attachment, because the fantasy is maybe if I'm enough, then they'll
be better.
I feel better and then they'll stay. You know, they're unavailable, but wouldn't it be wonderful if I could win over the availability, if I could overcome the availability by just being better, by just being more perfect, right? So there's this that totally fits in with that narrative of like, this is my fault, this is my ownership, and this is the way that I'm going to heal it. And of course that is never going to heal it, because really it's about the self-perception and the expectations within the relationship and those patterns, and that, you know, and actually feeling as if our needs and our worth are valid. And that's the thing which is going to bring about a healthy dynamic in a relationship, not being better and doing more, because you're already in.
We are just so complex, aren't we? Humans, we're great. So we've got secure, we've got anxious.
Mm-hmm.
What else have we got happening when it comes to attachment styles?
Yes, so then we have the dismissive or avoidant. And so, by the way, these two are usually pretty attracted to each other, like as in the avoidant attachment and the anxious attachment, because it fill each other's expectations.
Enough said, yeah.
So what ends up happening with a child who develops a dismissive attachment style or an avoidant attachment style is that they – in order to cope with the distress of their caregiver leaving or the inconsistency, is they retreat, they withdraw, and they kind of numb out, I suppose, from the needs that they have. They disconnect from those needs and they just try and seek them internally, you know. And a lot of the time also what happens is that they may, you know, have a caregiver who has lots and lots of changes in their emotional expression or behavior, and so it would actually be dangerous for this particular, you know, for the child to maintain ongoing connection with this caregiver, because they ultimately fear that they're going to kind of lose their safety and lose their sense of self by connecting in this way. So people with avoidant attachment, they have usually a positive view of themselves and a negative view of others. So this is opposite, right, to anxious attachment. And they usually have a high level of desire for independence. They tend to suppress or deny their feelings, again, because this is not something they're used to connecting with or showing others on the surface. They usually deal with rejection by distancing themselves and they tend to retreat into their own worlds when things get difficult.
Yeah, I know you mentioned rejection, but also with conflict.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which, as you said, you know, if an anxious attached person and an avoidant attached person are in a relationship and one's like, please reassure me, and the other one's like, please leave me alone, like I need to retreat. That's just got to be a recipe for lots of dis-ease in that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. So what typically happens is that in the beginning stage of a relationship between someone, between an anxious and an avoidant person, it's usually pretty good, because there's not enough intimacy for the avoidant person to feel threatened, you know, because they're still in the process.
A separate life, yeah.
Exactly. And they're also it's the honeymoon stage, so they're probably still communicating and giving the anxious person lots of attention and idealization, right? But then what ends up happening is as more intimacy comes about, as more intimacy develops in the relationship, that's when the fear of losing a sense of self comes about. And then, as you say, if conflict comes up, then the avoidant person will respond by retreating within themselves, creating distance and moving away. And the anxious person will want to seek out, they'll want to have conversations, they'll want to move towards
of
and they'll want
to
prepare.
Because that's kind of taking like the, it's a gross analogy, but like the scab off the top of the wound for the anxious person, because they're like, oh my gosh, there is something wrong here. Yeah, like it feeds that beast.
Exactly, yeah. But of course, this actually just kind of starts snowballing, because the more that the anxious person seeks the avoidant person out, the more the avoidant person pulls away. And so it just, doesn't usually end well. and really there needs to be for it, it's not that anxious and avoidant attachment styles, you know, can't work in a relationship. It's just really that there needs to be a level of awareness from both people that this is what they tend to do, and an awareness around, okay, and this is actually how I take responsibility for looking after myself, for noticing how I'm behaving, noticing how I'm showing up, and really agreeing on how you're going to deal with these sorts of situations where maybe conflict happens and you're kind of doing your anxious thing and you're doing your avoidant thing.
Having an understanding of each other's attachment styles must be so important, because then when you're able to not be sort of so in the emotional state, when you can kind of zoom out and feel a little more logical, you can then go, okay, I understand this is that person's blueprint and that's all their stuff, you know, and not take it so personally.
Understanding your partner's attachment style is the ultimate love language.
Yes, yes, of course. So many correlations with love language, but this obviously just runs so much deeper than, you know, the old acts of service and gifts and whatnot.
Yeah.
Are there other attachment styles, or are there like combinations of attachment styles? Can you be anxious avoidant?
You can have combinations just like anything. This all sits on a spectrum, and you can definitely have combinations of different ones. And something else that I tend to see as well is that you might have different attachment styles for, let's just say,
want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
That your parents are different genders, and you develop an association, you have an attachment style with one gender or one type of relationship, and you have a different attachment style with a different gender, right? So you might have, you know, avoidant attachments with women, and anxious attachments with men. That's a really common kind of dynamic.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that was something that was on my mind. I know a lot of people who have an anxious attachment to their father, say, for example, so then that translates into relationship, but then they're much more secure with their mum. So in friendships, they're not like continually chasing people down. They're pretty chill.
Yeah.
But in relationship, it's a whole other story.
Yeah, yeah. And don't forget that, you know, the stakes are higher when it comes to romantic attachment, you know.
And it's not the same, yeah.
So there's more likely to be that's more likely to activate some of the similar attachment styles, because there's more dependence, there's more risk, and it models kind of the attachment with caregivers in adulthood.
Well, I guess with that, you know, level of intimacy that only comes in a romantic partnership comes that level of vulnerability. And
absolutely,
when we're vulnerable, we're all exposed.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned that it can be a little tricky at times if an anxious and avoidant style, you know, couple develops. Is there an ideal combination?
Secure. There is always, or to, you know, if you're anxious to be in a relationship with someone who's secure, or if you're avoidant to be in a relationship with someone who's secure. And then, of course, there's fearful or disorganized attachment. And again, that'd be great if it was paired with secure attachment as well.
What are some traits of fearful or disorganized attachment?
This usually comes about when someone has experienced really inconsistent behaviors from their caregivers, maybe neglect or even abuse. So you're not just looking at the absence of the absence of nurture and care, or parents not being available. You're really looking at potentially incredibly disruptive and abusive behavior that really distorts people's perception of safety, you know, safety in their body, safety in their world, and safety within relationships. So what what this does is it actually tends to disrupt people's perceptions of themselves quite profoundly, and also their trust in others. So they have a negative view of themselves, and they have a negative view of other people, and they tend not to trust the intentions of other people. They also can respond by suppressing or denying their feelings. So, you know, in addition to trying to cope by suppressing how they feel, they also may just have experienced gaslighting from an early age, you know, where they're told that their feelings are wrong, or that they, you know, something doesn't exist, you know. So,
like, they're standing on shaky ground.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, really there's a lot of disorientation. And so this typically means that people who have fearful or avoidant attachment styles, they can completely avoid relationships altogether. They can just go, you know what, it's just not safe to be connected or to get close. Or they might do things that are really sabotaging, or they might be involved in trauma bonding, so really chaotic relationships that are super intense and then super destructive. And they might kind of not really be able to recognize the signs that this person really maybe isn't that good for them, you know, and they just kind of accept behavior that is abusive or not okay, because that's their blueprint for relationships. So how do they know otherwise? So it really can have a pretty profound impact on someone's life and someone's relationships moving forward when, you know, that's been their blueprint.
Yeah. We're all just victims of our upbringing, aren't we?
Well, we are very plastic, you know. Yeah. And it's you know, there's definitely some nature, you know, as well as nurture. So we definitely are born with temperament and characteristics, but we are, you know, it's incredible to think about how much the experiences that we have form and shape who we are, and how that then translates, you know, into who we become as adults. And of course, we don't think about any of these things usually until we become adults and we start going, why do I keep doing
this? Why am I like that?
Why does this keep happening to me, you know? And that's when we start to try and make sense of it and go, oh, I learned to do that back then, or I learned to cope in that way back then. And that's why, you know. So, and I guess I want to say, because, you know, when we start thinking about this, it can sort of make people feel a bit sad, which it is sad, or maybe a little bit powerless. But, you know, really the thing to remember is that all of these things can be healed, and you can actually have relationships which are really healing. So, you know, if you experience a securely attached relationship, that can actually change your attachment style. And also, if you're able to work through it and understand these things for yourself, and you go to therapy and you do lots of wonderful healing, you know, all of these things can be you know, can be altered or changed. So there's hope. Don't feel like just because you're stuck in that cycle, or that you're kind of noticing these things for the first time, that, you know, that means it's going to be like that forever. There's definitely you can do.
Yeah, of course. And as you mentioned, we are plastic. So we're plastic in the sense of, like, we take in everything and we can be molded into one of these attachment styles. But we're also plastic in the way of going, oh, I have awareness now, and I'm going to learn new behaviors and try and learn new thought patterns and processes. Mm-hmm. One of my questions is, do different people bring out different sides of your attachment styles? Like, could someone be triggered into being more, I don't know, avoidant when in another relationship they might be more secure? Can you swing between the styles, I guess, depending on the relationship?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think it's interesting to sort of look at what's actually going on, because, like, let's just take the example of someone who's anxiously attached, right? So let's just say they have a relationship with someone who's really emotionally unavailable, and maybe it's really quite difficult, and they sort of go, oh, I'm never going to do that again, you know, I'm never going to be with someone who doesn't give me what I want and who doesn't pay attention to me. And so what can happen then is that they seek out someone who's they overcompensate for this, right? So they seek out someone who's extremely available and really almost kind of similar to them, perhaps. They're also anxious, you know. And because this is actually unfamiliar, and also because it's not really coming from a secure place either, this can mean that person kind of starts going, oh, no, this doesn't feel right at all.
They get the ick, Sarah. Yeah. That's what we call it. They get the ick.
Exactly. So I guess I'd wonder if that might be part of the reason why there's such a swing, you know, not that necessarily our...
More by design.
Exactly. That different situations are going to bring out different things in our attachment styles, you know. And attachment, it's more complicated than attachment styles, you know. It's something that a type of therapy that I use is schema therapy. That's probably a little bit more of a nuanced way of describing the complexity of attachments, because these blueprints that we form they're pretty complicated. So it's really important to get a very clear picture for you of what your blueprint is, because that's when you're going to be able to see, you know, the sorts of patterns in situations that tend to trigger you, you know, sort of behavior in other people that tends to trigger you, you know, and then once you have a really good idea about that, that's when you can start to make some changes.
And you mentioned that, you know, relationships can be quite healing when it comes to moving through our own trauma and triggers. Can you also work on your attachment style if you're not in a romantic relationship, or is it something that you really do need to be in relationship with another person to be able to go, oh, this has been brought to the surface?
Absolutely, you can. So the main kind of pathway to healing attachment styles is to become securely attached with yourself. So what we tend to notice is that we respond to our own internal experiences with our attachment style. So we have these relationships with, you know, parts of ourselves that feel afraid, or parts of ourselves that feel blocked off, you know. So actually we can do so much healing by being a good parent to ourselves, you know. And we call this the process of reparenting, you know. So figuring out what it feels like to feel secure and stable and honor your needs and set appropriate boundaries and, you know, communicate about what's important to you. You know, all of these things are about being securely attached and loving yourself, you know, and that's the thing that's going to put you in really good stead for whatever kind of connections you build moving forward.
I love that. I'm so fascinated by the reparenting approach, and I think that it's so important. I would love to have you back on to discuss reparenting at a later date, because it's definitely something that needs more airtime. So if you are avoidant in relationship, it's likely, and again, this is a question, is it likely then that you might be avoidant in your relationship? So rather than just feeling what you feel, you'll lean into behaviors that aren't serving you because it's more comfortable for you to avoid that. Is that what you're saying when you say work on yourself with your attachment style?
So, I mean, an example of how you could work on yourself if you, say, for example, have an avoidant attachment style is that you might notice this in relationships that you have that aren't romantic. So you might notice it in work relationships or friendships as well. But typically people who are avoidantly attached, usually they're not particularly good at connecting with and feeling their emotions and also setting boundaries in their life, you know. So really it's about the attunement that they have with themselves and their ability to prioritize and communicate how they feel. And so that's something that you can learn to do through, meditating, through being able to notice sensations in your body, pick up on emotional states, through being able to learn skills for communicating about, you know, how you feel, even if you're doing that by yourself. So, you know, even if you're keeping a journal and you're writing about how you feel, and just noticing typically how you respond when things get difficult, you know, and noticing what's the fear, where's that fear coming from, and that fear was genuine perhaps when you were a child where the attachment formed, but actually right now you're safe, you're okay, you know, and that what you need to do in this situation in order to get what you need is to, for example, you know, say, I really want to be there for you right now, but I don't feel like I have the emotional or mental capacity. Can we make it time to talk tomorrow, right? So there's a way of creating independence and also creating connection at the same time. And that's really the key for somebody who's avoidantly attached, is to figure out how to do that, that they don't, it's not about choosing, you know, connection or independence and internal safety. It's about being able to kind of have that, have the duality of those at the same time, and figuring out how to feel safe when you're close to other people.
Skill set to really practice.
Mm.
A question that I imagine some listeners will have is, what if you are in a romantic relationship and you're really working on your attachment style and you have a bit of a grip and a bit of an understanding and you're really trying to take accountability for whatever attachment style you know have, but your partner doesn't really either believe in it, buy into it, isn't interested in it, doesn't want to know about it? How can you continue to grow together in that situation?
Yep, I've heard this story.
That's why I'm like, I'm just going to ask this question, Sarah, because it's a question that, you know, I know that someone will send me a message and say, I listened to your episode and I'm doing the work, but my partner's not doing the work. What do I do?
Well, usually what I encourage people to think about is actually what this means for the broader context of your relationship. So a lot of the time, you know, the reason why somebody doesn't want to do the work actually might be connected to how they view their role in the relationship, how they think relationships work, how invested they are in the relationship, honestly, and also how, what they actually think is important for the connection, you know. So sometimes it's just not actually very clear to the other person why this is really important. You know, it's not actually part of their perception of what is important when it comes to a relationship. You know, so, and we can reference love languages in this context. Perhaps they really think, you know what, I'm actually, you know, the work I'm doing for this relationship is to go out, to earn money so that we can have stability and we can have the things that we need in our life. And that's how they view, you know,
supporting. Their contribution.
Exactly. And so they don't really understand, perhaps, you know, why this would be so important, right? So it's really about getting on the same page to, first of all, understand the purpose behind this, you know, and really understanding and listening to your partner or partner's perspective on what they see as being important and how they see the relationship and their role in it. And once you're on the same page, it might be a lot more helpful. But I guess the other thing to add to this as well is that if you do the work, it's going to help your relationship, you know, and everyone is on their own healing journey. And sometimes, you know, people in a relationship are not at the same place in that healing journey. And that's really frustrating. But if you're doing work on yourself and you're meeting your own needs and you're working on regulating yourself, then that will likely really influence the dynamic within the relationship, you know? And then, you know, your partner or partners might notice this and they might go, oh, that's pretty good. Well, you know, what? And if they see the impact, that might be a really good motivator, you know? The other option is to, you know, to try and see if they'd be interested to come to relationship therapy, and then a psychologist can help explain why it's important.
Sometimes it's easier received from a third party.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Something that I've heard Esther Perel say is that she thinks of relationships as the space between two people.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sits with me in terms of going, okay, there are two people here, and we both need to be making deposits or contributions towards that space. And it's very rare, I think, that, you know, throughout a whole relationship that the contributions or deposits are going to be 50-50 matched. There are going to be times when someone is doing a little more of the heavy lifting than the other person, and it might come out in the wash over time.
Mm. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think there's, if you're looking at, you know, the way that people move and evolve within their life. You know, that's just, it's not a, you're not always going to be in the same place, and it's not going to be a kind of, you know, linear process where you're, you know, both in alignment, or you're both doing the same kind of work, or, you know, you have the same kind of resources, you know. And I think that what's really important is to acknowledge and give some words and meaning to this, you know, because once you can make sense of this and you know where you want to go together, you know, and you have shared articulated goals and you know your positioning within that, it can be just so, so helpful. So it's not necessarily about getting anyone to move any different place. It might be more about being able to appreciate and articulate where you're at and what you need from each other to be supported in that space.
Absolutely. I feel like I would be a little bit remiss not to just quickly ask the question, given that so much of all of our attachment style comes back to good old childhood, and I know a lot of people listening either have children or are going to go on to have kids. What are some ways that we as parents can try and instill that secure style attachment from a young age?
That is a good question. Well, I think this is something that that parents can be pretty anxious about if they know about attachment theory. And I think the thing to remember is that you turned out okay, so it's all right.
No one gets it perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Look, I think that, you know, you just need to keep in mind all the things that are really important for growing a human and for that are part of human needs. So safety and stability and consistency in the way that you respond, and to allow a child to be expressive, but also to set limits and to show them how they can regulate themselves, show them how they can have, doing a task, achieve a task, you know, that they're okay if they're left alone, that you will come back, you know. So we can really look at attachment theory and look at what secure attachment involves, and that's a really good model for the behaviors that would be really useful. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, if you're coming from a space of love and good intention, that's the most important thing, you know. You can't be everything and do everything, and you know, really that the space of love and care and the importance that you're placing on, you know, your child's well-being is the thing that will translate the most to their blueprint, because that's the thing that they will feel, and that's what they will absorb.
And something I often share, I've spoken about it on the podcast, I'm sure, but, you know, just in real life, in conversation, when I'm speaking with parents who perhaps are taking on quite a bit of responsibility for the way that their children are presenting, and I can put my hand up and say, I've done this. I have nearly 8-year-old twin boys, and one is very anxious. And I'm often like, oh my gosh, what have I done to cause this anxiety? But the thing that I find comfort in, and I often share, is I have identical twins, and one is so independent and one is so secure, and the other one just is so much needier and so much more anxious. Same DNA, identical twins, raised by the same people, but presenting to have totally different attachment styles. So I guess I just wanted to add that in, because I don't want parents to think, oh my gosh, it's, you know, all completely on me, because some of it obviously has to come from them, from their own, you know, the way they see themselves.
Yeah. The really important thing to remember is that, you know, there's the parent's behavior, but then it's the child's perception.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And children don't have all the resources to understand the complexities of adult behavior, you know. So this is, I also say this to people when they're thinking and making sense of their childhood, and they're like, oh, I don't want to blame my parents. They really did love me, and they did, you know, want to do a good job. It, it is really about that internal interpretation, and that's not something that parents have control over, you know, how children make sense of that. And then you've kind of got this complex web of, like, you know, temperament, and then you know, the first kind of internalized experiences, and then how they then impact on what is internalized moving forward. So you've kind of got this really complex infrastructure internally that just kind of reflects off each other and influences the way that that person interacts with the outside world, you know. So it's fascinating, and also there's a lot there which is completely outside of the control of parents.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for having this chat today and explaining attachment theory to us. Where can our listeners connect with you?
You can find us on Instagram, so that's at Ship Psychology, and Facebook, it's Ship Psychology, or you can check out our website, www.shippsychology.com.au.
Brilliant. I will put that in the show notes, but I will definitely recommend to everyone who is listening right now, while this interview, this podcast episode is wrapping up, jump over and find Ship Psychology on Instagram. It is an account you want in your feed. That's how I found Sarah, because I was just seeking out accounts that were going to bring information to me that I have been, I guess, just not super aware of. And I have found following the Ship Psychology account super, super helpful and enlightening and insightful. So I recommend doing that. And again, Sarah, thank you so much. Lots of food for thought in this chat today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great. This is what I want. Don't have to go, I can set you free. Are you gonna make a move? Are you gonna come and see? Whatever you wanna do, you know it's cool with me. Whisper in the dark, whispers in the dark. You come to play, don't you? Looking for something new. I got a lot underneath, tricks up my
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.